Hey, before we kick things off, I have a quick word from our sponsor, Alarm Grid. Alarm Grid is a do-it-yourself security company without the gimmicks, hidden fees, and crazy contracts that you will experience all over the alarm industry. You get a free month if you're one of our listeners by going to alarmgrid.com/longform. Here's the show. Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Max Linsky. Evan Ratliff is a recent father. We'll return soon.
Hey, Aaron.
Hi. We just had a good, we had a brainstorming session where we brainstormed the next 6 months or so of guests on the show. It's excellent.
With Evan out, we decided to make a bunch of decisions.
Yes, yes. We've changed everything. It's all on this piece of paper, but exciting times. We've got a lot of great guests coming up.
It's a lot of incredibly ambitious names who will never return our calls.
Ernest Hemingway will be on the show later this month. This week on the show, I had Ross Anderson, who is the editor of what I would say is the best magazine you have not heard of. If you have not heard of it, it's Aeon Magazine. It's a magazine of ideas, I think is how they describe it. I would describe it as a very broad understanding of science, both its history and its philosophical underpinnings. They publish a ton of stuff with a very tiny staff, which I find quite impressive.
I like how you're just like, I don't really like your description of your magazine. Here's another way to put it.
But we had a really good conversation.
Yep. Ross Anderson's a good man. Also good people down there at MailChimp in Atlanta. They make a product called Tiny Letter. And it's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter, and we thank them for their continued support of the show. They make this thing possible.
I love to see people on Twitter saying that they're thinking about starting a tiny letter.
Yeah, I love it more when people say they started a tiny letter.
Hey, thinking it is the first, very first step. as long as we're taking first steps, I'd love it if everyone listening to the show, if they have an iPhone or an iPad, took a step towards downloading our app. It's the Longform app. It's totally free. It's a great way to read the writers and publishers you hear about on this show. If you're about to go on a summer vacation, maybe you're not going to have great internet access the whole time. Everything's available offline that you get in the app. So take it with you. Read, read, read.
Here's Aaron with Ross Anderson.
Welcome, Ross Anderson.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Ross, you are the senior editor at Aeon Magazine?
Deputy editor.
Deputy editor.
Whoa. Yeah.
You just got yourself a promotion.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people listening to the show, if you follow Longform, you probably are familiar with Aeon because we post a lot of Aeon stories. Mm. But if you don't follow Longform, the website, not the podcast, closely, you might not know what Aeon is.
Yeah.
It's not a huge profile magazine. It's fairly new.
Sure.
It's web only. But you guys have done what I think is a pretty incredible job of, you're putting up a feature every day, pretty much?
Four days a week.
Yeah, okay.
4 days a week.
You're a new web publication, and you're publishing at a clip that's about on par with The New Yorker.
Yeah, wow, when you put it like that.
Were you part of the decision to publish at that rate, or was that a job given to you from above?
It was definitely a job given to me from above, but one that I accepted eagerly.
How different would your life be if you were to to reduce that to, and I should note that these are not filler. These are mostly 5,000 word features.
We go deep, you know.
Go deep.
I mean, I would say, you know, the stuff we publish is probably in a range from 2,500 words all the way up to the obnoxiously long stuff I do at like 8,000-9,000 words. I mean, we cover ideas. And they're
So that's how you define it, as ideas.
For sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Which gives us a break. I mean, we don't do much reportage, right?
Right.
Like, we're not sending you to, you know, go cover ISIS in Syria.
But the ideas that you cover are not generally the hot take ideas of that news cycle. I'm interested in, like, from an editorial standpoint, like, do you have arguments about what's an idea and what's not an idea?
Wow. Great question. Yeah. I mean, I feel like early on in our life, we did a lot more memoir. I mean, people knew that so it's standard to call them features. Maybe we're a little bit precious in that we call them essays.
Yes.
But by using that word, we attracted a lot of attention from people who write personal essays or memoir-driven stuff.
Right.
And not only is that kind of not what we do, it's not core to our mission, but it kind of died on the vine for us, unless unless you had someone who's like an amazing talent, like Mary Kay Choi,
right.
Heather Havrilesky, like people like that, you know, they can come write a personal essay for us that almost is ideas journalism in a way, because they're just, I mean, they're able to traffic in stuff that are truly human universals.
I've had conversations about, like, don't write about yourself until you've written something really good, not about yourself. That kind of writing is maybe the easiest to do with a low budget, but mm-hmm. it's not, you don't want to read the 100 versions of it. You only want to read the very best version of it. On the other hand, a lot of what you guys cover is science journalism, which is not proliferating on the internet. It's not the new hot vertical. So when you're choosing stories, you got four slots a week. Are you thinking about a diversity of stories across a week?
Yeah. And I should say that, so my editor-in-chief, Bridget Haynes, who's, I mean, nothing short of a polymath. I mean, she's looking at this stuff from 30,000 feet across all these kind of intellectual domains and seeding the schedule so that, yeah, diversity is like a huge, huge key of what we do. And it's interesting. I mean, unlike the New Yorker, for instance, not that, you know, that's an appropriate comparison, but it's not like we have this huge print subscriber base where no matter, you know, kind of what the quality of the features are that particular week, they go out there and everybody loves them. Like, we get instant feedback on what we do, right?
Right.
And when we slip on diversity, like when we have too many things that are like three psychology pieces in a week or three science pieces, like hard science pieces in a week, the audience notices and they're kind of like, hey.
How do you gauge that? Because I think print magazines often gauge that through a form of voodoo. You're a digital-only magazine. How do you know when a piece sucked?
We believe in the market, right? Like, you know, analytics, you know? I mean, if we're not making all our distinctions based on like, oh, you know, you can tell how good a piece is by how much traffic it does. But you've got a basket of things in the digital world, right? You've got like response on Twitter and Facebook. You've got, you know, does it, because we cover ideas, there's kind of a devoted blogosphere almost for everything that we cover.
Right.
How is our piece showing up there? Is it making an impact? Is it starting conversations? And then, but traffic is the biggest thing. It has to be.
Right.
You know what I mean? We want to be heard.
How long have you been at Aon?
That's a tricky question. Like, it's funny. Like, I wasn't a full-time staff member until June of 2013, but I did, like, one of the first pieces for the magazine. So I feel like, hey, wait a minute.
You've been there for a couple of years.
So I feel like an Aon OG.
I know that you're, like, I've gotten coffee with you in the Bay Area. I know that this is, like, not a, it's not, like, a traditional 9-to-5 job that you can just turn on and off. Like, how... Mm. For people out there who listen to this show, I think a lot of people think about, wow, I could start a publication. I could do this. Like, going in a few years from 0 to 60 on four features a week, how are you getting pitches? How are you getting enough material to fill out that roster?
I mean, it is just, we are constantly out there. Like, we're seeking people out, right? I don't think being a new-ish publication, I mean, it's funny. Like, we, you see us as a new publication because you've got people in here from the New York Times Magazine all the time.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, wait, we've been around here 3 years. Yeah, we're established. But, you know, being a new-ish publication, we're still grinding, right? We're still sending, you know, stuff out to people all the time going, hey, write for us, please.
Where do you find the people that you send that out to?
Because we focus on ideas, we have a distinct advantage where we do go after high-profile academics a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll write to people and say, hey, look, we can make your ideas sing on the page, right? Yeah. You're already a talented writer. You're in the ideas business. You know, come to us and, like, lay out some new thinking for us, you know, at length at 3,000-4,000 words, and we'll help you. We'll polish it to a shine.
I used to work in book publishing.
Wow.
And generally, academics were considered personas non gratas.
Yeah.
Generally, academic writing is frowned upon as a popular pursuit for readers. How do you identify who like big academics who might be able to write something for a mass audience for you are?
That's a two-step process. I mean, first, it starts at the idea.
But are you reading academic journals to find? Like, where
sometimes,
do you get,
you know, or you're reading academic blogs, right? Or a nice filter, right? Because they're like, oh, here's a bright, shiny idea. Each of us has like beats, right? Uh-huh. Spread across the kind of the whole sort of academic spectrum.
Yeah.
And we'll pay attention to blogs. The science is on Twitter.
Right.
They're all there talking to each other all day, right? So you can eavesdrop on that stuff and be like, who's at the center of that, that we can go commission to do something really bold on it.
And when you get someone, you're like, wow, you are the astrophysics shit. Like, you are a very important person in astrophysics.
Yeah.
You have an important idea. I need you to write a 5,000-word feature that explains this to a layman. Like, what is that process like?
You have to be discerning, right? I think when I first started this job, I went, I'm not going to name names, but like, you know, we had the experience you had in book publishing, right?
Yeah.
Where you go to academics and you are really excited because they're really interesting thinkers, but then they send in the first draft and it's just garbage, right?
Yeah.
Like, they have no feel for structure. Pro style is just wooden. They have kind of a legal brief style, right? Where it's like, here's what I'm going to argue.
It's very...
Watch me argue it.
Yeah, it's almost like, I've proved this point. Now let me prove it three or four more times in a different way. That's sort of the general... I mean, and that's... It's a format.
Yeah.
It's not a format that's really intended to fit into the user experience of someone reading an article. So is that like a... do you edit them heavily?
What we do is we look for that kind of Venn diagram person who is, you know, I mean, and look, they're few and far between and, you know, people are looking for, you know, we're not the only people seeking them. Like a good friend of mine, Caleb Scharf, he runs the astrobiology department at Columbia and happens to be a fantastic lyrical prose stylist.
Right.
You know, so...
Do you go back and like look at that person's previous writing and sort of look for hints of good writing?
For sure. Okay. Yeah, yeah. You I mean,
your job seems very hard. I mean, there's a lot of background for getting one or a few pieces.
There's some panning for gold for sure.
Yeah.
But it's worth it. You know, it feels good. Like when you feel like someone passed a new idea kind of into the broader cultural world through your magazine.
What do you do when you get an academic and you're like, this person's got potential, but... they're kind of stuck in this academic writing style and you say, well, could you change this? And they're like, no, like I've experienced great success with this writing style.
For the business that we're in, you know, and kind of the kind of writing that we promote and commission, you know, we're up there, I feel like.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got a little swag now when we go into these conversations, but also it just doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
You know, we just tell them like, no, you know, I mean, that's actually, you know, that's not going to fly as an essay. 10 people are going to read that. That's why 10 people know about it now.
Right.
We feel comfortable kind of saying, hey, like, you know, you're the thinker.
Yeah.
You know, let us help you translate.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here quickly for a word from our sponsor, Alarm Grid. Alarm Grid is a do-it-yourself security company focused on the customer experience. Their idea is to make getting an alarm set up easy for you without gimmicks, hidden fees, or crazy contracts. So maybe you've been thinking about getting an alarm for your house or your office. If you've done any research at all, you know that there's two basic scams that are worked in this industry. Either you're paying a ton upfront for the equipment, or you're getting the equipment free and you have a contract that lasts until you are 100 years old. Alarm Grid does the opposite. It's straightforward. There's no activation fee, no monitoring fee. They don't get you to buy a bunch of stuff you don't need. They give you the bare minimum, which you can install yourself. I am not the greatest handyman. It took me under 5 minutes. You install it, and then you pay for service by the month, cancel whenever you want. If you want to go with a different service provider, fine. That is a very futuristic way to look at an alarm service. I encourage you to go to alarmgrid.com/longform. You'll get a month free as one of our listeners, and you will be on the way to a more secure office or home. Thank you, Alarm Grid. Is there sort of a division? Because you've also written extensively about big ideas in science. Do you have like a tension where you're like, okay, I've got an idea that's really valid, but I've got the person who's behind this idea is the wrong person to write this idea. I need to get a writer and have them profile this person.
For sure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say we do a ton of profile pieces because the science profiles can feel so cookie cutter.
Yeah.
I would rather have a writer who's actually willing to step in and kind of like get behind the idea a little bit, which is less straightforward journalism. It's kind of a weird in between thing, but absolutely what we call in, you know, call in, say, a writer to say, hey, you know, here's a bright, shiny idea over here.
Yeah.
Can you kind of synthesize this whole field?
Which is kind of how I would describe a lot of your own pieces. So you had a piece last week about cosmology, which I mistook when you emailed for cosmetology, which shows my built-in knowledge of cosmology. The piece starts off as sort of the history of cosmology, and then it gets into a rather bitter fight about a concept in modern cosmology. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great example of a piece that I would have previously said, I do not give a shit about this. I have never thought about cosmology. I don't know anything about it. And for you to write this piece, you had to research the entire history of cosmology. Like, how long do you dedicate to doing something like that?
This piece was a long time in coming. If you recall, I saw you and Max out for pizza back in
Dumbo Connection.
November. Yeah. And I was actually out here at Princeton to report that piece. I had been writing about space science for a little bit now. I worked with Alexis Madrigal at The Atlantic, was kind of where I got my start. And he let me do some real fun sort of fact-finding Q&As with these really big thinkers in cosmology, in space science, in astronomy, that kind of helped me find my feet in the field. But look, you say, hey, I never thought I'd be interested in this, right?
Yeah.
But like, I bet as a kid you were interested, right, in like the stars and
that kind
of thing, right?
Yeah.
I think when you write about these subjects, you've got to tap into that. And I'm not going to sit here and make a claim like my piece did that, but that's what I was trying to do.
No, I mean, I agree with that notion. The in-between land that you end up as a writer with in terms of that piece is you're trying to tap into that sort of childlike wonder, mm-hmm. and you're trying to tap into an academic feud mm-hmm. at the highest level,
yeah.
and you're trying to deliver that to a lay reader. When you have all of those chords tugging at you, how do you organize that process of getting educated at the lowest and highest level?
Yeah, what a great question.
This is a very flattering interview. I'm getting a lot of good questions back at me, which is just encouraging.
No, I keep it up. Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Like, that piece in particular is hard, right? I mean, those ideas. Look, I was fortunate. Like, I went and spent a week with Paul Steinart, who's the director of theoretical sciences at Princeton.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, he spoon-fed me, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, day one, we were at the chalkboard.
Do you have a background in science?
No. I mean, I did in undergrad. I went to UC Irvine, which has, like, maybe the best philosophy of science department, and I studied philosophy of science in particular.
Oh, okay.
Which was like, I mean, I was kind of a shitty student. Like, I was just lucky to kind of catch some stuff on the fly there while I was there. But that gave me kind of a grounding in some of these big
issues. What is the philosophy of science?
What is the philosophy of science? The philosophy of science is concerned with like some really abstract and boring sounding questions, like what does it even mean to prove a theory?
Uh-huh.
Right? Or, you know, you talk about things like cosmology, like that the universe had a beginning some 13 billion years ago, that it has an ending that we can maybe even describe and predict that's like tens, if not hundreds of billions, if not trillions of years away. And like, what does that mean? I mean, that's the kind of broader philosophy of science that I'm interested in.
But did you have ambitions to pursue science as a scientist?
No, I mean, one of the things I love about writing is, like, for instance, this piece. I went deep on cosmology for, like, 7 months, wrung it out, had lots of interesting thoughts flying around in my mind, and then now I'm, like, onto something else, right? Where, like, people who are practitioners in cosmology, like, that's 30 years,
right? It's the rest of their life.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think there's a perception that, oh, you're interested in science, you should become a scientist. And the people that you write about and the people that Aeon generally profiles, these aren't people who got a PhD in science. These are like LeBron James level scientists.
For sure.
Like, if you had pursued science, not to insult you, you weren't going to become one of these people that you're profiling or that you're interviewing. Like, you're in some ways like George Plimpton playing with the Detroit Lions.
I'd be like sweeping the floor of the observatory, you know? Like, I mean, that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, and I count it a privilege to even like play some tiny role in communicating some of the exciting ideas that are out there and like sending those out into the world.
So I'm interested in what those interpersonal interactions are like, because I get to, in my chair here at Longform, I get to deal with some of the best journalists in America. I mean that very sincerely. Like, and it's something I know I never could be. And I asked them, how do you do your job? So when you're sitting down with the top 10 figures in cosmology in the world, like, How do you mediate that interaction when they say something to you and they're describing a concept and you don't get it? Yeah. What do you say?
I say I don't get it. Okay. I mean, for sure. Yeah.
Do you eventually get it, or what is the path from not getting it to getting it when you're dealing with a subject like that?
I mean, I feel like it's just being annoying and just like forcing them over and over to cram it into some kind of comprehensible language. Like, yeah. I mean, I did a cover story for Scientific American a couple years ago about this atom interferometer like instrument that was meant to find gravity waves, kind of related to this cosmology piece. But anyway, I went back. I was living in D.C. at the time, and these guys were at NASA Goddard, which is right outside D.C., maybe like 45 minutes away. And, you know, I went back over and over, you know, I emailed them like, hey, yeah. I still don't get it. Like, can I come in? And they were cool, you know? Yeah. And so I'd come in and, here's the thing. I should say this about scientists.
Yeah.
When I was first writing for Alexis at The Atlantic, I'm interested in lots of things. I love politics. I like looked around at writing about those different worlds, and it seemed like it was, I remember I had a buddy who was a pretty top flight lobbyist.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, I can get you some sit down time with so and so, this senator. And I was like, wow, okay, you know, let's do it. And the hoops that I had to jump through to get like 3 minutes with pre approved questions.
Yeah.
And I'm like lazy, you know, like I won't do all that. And so, science, like I went to write this piece about the James Webb Space Telescope for the LA Review of Books.
Yeah.
And there's a woman at MIT named Sarah Seeger who, basically, I mean, it's in science, you can no longer say that a single person invented something anymore. Like, that's just not, it's huge teams, right?
Yeah.
But like, she was instrumental, like the top person in figuring out how you could look at a distant planet, right? Like orbiting another star and figure out whether there was life there.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's, you know, that's a big thing, right?
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And you email her like, hey, I'm a dumb person. I want to find out about what you do. And she's like, do you want to talk tomorrow for 2 hours?
Yeah.
You know? So I was like, okay, look at politics, which is interesting, but those people are, you know, they're not trafficking in those like big, interesting things that are going to be interesting for a long time.
Right.
Right. Like questions like, is there life on other planets? That's going to be an interesting question for a long time.
Yeah.
This woman is at the vanguard of human beings who are trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
And you could like be in a room with her for 3 hours the next day.
Right.
Yeah.
So is 3 hours enough though?
No.
Like it seems to me like some of these things are like, just to do one of these pieces is almost like a full semester's
worth
of research.
They'll take your annoying follow-up questions.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Yeah. They are, the good ones are cognizant that they need you on some level.
So
right.
That's an interesting question, because like when you were talking about access there, mm-hmm. the first thing, like people who've been on this show, mm-hmm. access is generally a question about celebrities, generally artists, musicians, et cetera. And mm-hmm. people have talked about the sort of the difficulty of writing profiles when you have very limited access. And it seems like here you have pretty strong access. What is the motivation for these scientists? Are they trying to popularize these ideas?
They're doing cool things that like 100 people know about. If you get at elite institutions, take Columbia. Yep. You know who Brian Greene is?
No.
He wrote that book, The Elegant Universe. He's on TV all the time,
yes.
Right? People who come up in astrophysics departments at Columbia notice who the big dog is.
Yeah.
And they know why he's the big dog, because he like has cultivated that media skill set.
That media skill set, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm not saying that the people I talk to are careerists. I'm just saying that like they're, you know, it's, they're not stupid, clearly.
Right.
And they know that like people like me are useful to them.
That's in many ways an incredible opportunity as a young journalist, that you have access to, up to the very top. When you were starting out, I'm interested in like what were your first gigs as a science journalist?
The first thing I did, I wrote like a bad essay that no one should Google.
It will be in the show notes now that you've mentioned it on the show.
I wrote this short piece for the Atlantic Tech about kind of the like space exploration, which, I mean, I've written more interesting things about that subject since.
Right on. So, but, like, how did you get in with the Atlantic at that point to even get that out the door?
You know, I was like, this is, I feel like every story about a writer, but particularly my story, is always like the like kind of like here's a series of lucky things that happened to me, you know?
Yeah.
I was early on Twitter. Yeah. I just, you know, I figured out that it was a cool thing to like track information across kind of like lots of fields early on. And so I followed Alexis. He followed me. In this case, I also followed Nick Jackson, who's now at Pacific Standard,
yeah.
who runs their website. And he said they were kind of soliciting essays for a collection about the 50th anniversary of human space travel. And I was like, I have some thoughts about that.
Did you know that you wanted to be a journalist for your career at that point?
I was in law school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You finished the philosophy of science and you went straight to law school?
There was some stuff in between, but yeah. I'm going to post this interview on my Facebook and some of my best law school friends who I love dearly are going to listen, but I was bored.
Yeah.
And,
How deep into law school were you?
This was late in my first year. I was at Georgetown, so I was in DC. I was flying around on Twitter at night, you know, and reading tons of science journalism and just fascinated with that area.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like an aspiring science journalist by any stretch, but I was like, hey, you know, when I was younger, I had like the proverbial novel in a drawer that was complete garbage. And I mean, if I found it, I'd be like horrified. Like,
yeah.
I hope it's nowhere in the cloud out there. But yeah, so like, I was like, hey, I know how to string a word or two together. You know, maybe this is something I could take a swing at. And yeah, that one did okay. But I mean, it's like, seriously, it's really bad. Alexis
and then you
gave me
start
a shot.
With Alexis,
yeah, yeah, like he. I think like I was a lot more raw of a writer at the time, but he, you know, saw that I was chasing after big ideas, and he's an idea person.
Yeah,
and so he gave me a shot. You know.
So did you finish law school?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're a lawyer.
Oh no,
you're
I didn't take the bar.
Barred.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not barred.
Okay, so you finished law school, but you didn't. I mean, what did you do after you finished?
So I wrote this piece my second year for the LA Review of Books on the James Webb Space Telescope that was pretty well received in the science world.
Yeah.
And Bridget, our genius editor-in-chief, reached out to me. Aeon wasn't even a thing yet. Like, they were like barely had a holding site. And she was like, I loved your piece. Like, you know, before the world takes you away, like, please write something for us. So I did this big piece about bristlecone pines. Same kind of thing. Took me like 5 months to write. Like, I'm slow.
Yeah.
You know, I like to
this
like...
This is a piece not... I mean, calling it about pine cones seems slightly reductive. It's sort of about the history of the universe as measured by rings in trees, including
bristlecone pines.
Bristlecone pines, yes.
It's a massive piece for sure. Yeah. No, I don't... I mean, look, you've... poor you has had to like read through my work maybe in some condensed period of time.
About
like
3 hours ago.
Yeah. So like you've noticed a theme, like I'm obsessed with deep time and like kind of these huge time scales. And so I wrote this big piece for them about bristlecone pines right when they started. It did well. They asked me to do another piece. I went to Oxford to report it. This big piece about human extinction. That did well. And so I was maybe like 3 months from graduating law school, I had a firm job lined up in LA. Like,
what kind of law were you going to do?
Litigation, white collar litigation, and they were like, "Hey, come work with us." And
do you imagine alternate lives for yourself where you're a litigator right now?
I do. I'll tell you what, like, I haven't looked back though.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can only imagine that one of those things is more lucrative than the other. I don't know what your salary at Aeon is, but I know what the salary of a commercial litigator is. Mm. So
my wife could probably tell you the difference to the dollar, but in all seriousness, she has been, I mean, she was like, look, my wife and I are high school sweethearts.
Wow.
And so I used to write notes from her to her back and forth back in the day. And she's like, oh, I always knew you'd be a writer. Like, she was such a romantic about it. She's like, go get it.
Well, I mean, and you're in a position now, like, you know, Alexis kind of plucked you out of law school future. And you are kind of now in a position to do that for other young law students / journalists. Like, I keep coming back to this. Like, you guys do 4 features a week just because I think it's kind of amazing. But I also come to it because I don't understand how that works pragmatically. Are you looking for people who can write science and are young and kind of unhoned?
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone who's in the business of what we do, if you're not looking at the emerging writer scene, you're not doing your job, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, it's hack work to just pay the best people to just do it over and over, right? So, yeah, I'm out there looking for sure. And we get stuff in the, like, for instance... there's a writer named Grayson Clary who I think he's done some stuff for either the New Inquiry and or N plus one in addition to the piece that he wrote for me. But yeah, so this guy was like studying Middle Kingdom Egyptian at Yale and had this idea to write for a piece for us about kind of cultural continuity with language.
Yeah.
And he has this really distinctive style. It was such a knockout piece. I loved it. And yeah, so like people like that, you know, they come in through the slush pile. We take a chance on them for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've written about Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. You wrote I think probably the first like big profile I read of Elon Musk and his ambitions to go to Mars.
Yeah.
To not to go to Mars for sport, but to go to Mars for the to save humanity.
To save humanity, yeah.
And if you look at like Elon Musk's ideas about science, Elon Musk is the founder of Tesla and SpaceX. There's an idea even within the technology industry that we used to take on the big ideas, and now we're taking on the small ideas.
We got the Yo app, you know.
Right. We used to want to go to Mars. Now we want instant grocery delivery.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a match for how we regard science in terms of journalism, where if you have a startup in San Francisco, you can get a lot of press coverage. As I've been talking to you, people who are at the very top of many scientific fields are desperate to get a single piece written about them.
Yeah.
Do you see that as an advantage you have as a science journalist?
For sure.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't want to tell you that, you know, like I want to scare people away from my beat. Yeah. But yeah, I feel like, no, I've been lucky that there's like not a lot of people looking at there's a lot of people looking at Elon Musk.
Yes.
For sure. He's an interesting guy.
That's
been all observation. One thing that was interesting to me about him is, so I've been telling you right in the course of this interview that one of the things that was really refreshing about dealing with scientists as opposed to say politicians or most business people is that scientists are like wonderfully candid. They'll talk shit on their colleagues.
Yes.
You know, like they're just firing on all cylinders all the time because they traffic in ideas and like that's what's important to them.
The major person they answer to is not their boss. It's science.
It's science. I mean, look, it's a human, right, like activity and they're driven by all the concerns that you and me and all this. That's one of the things that's so interesting about science, right, is that it's a human endeavor. And so all the weird flaws and foibles that you see anywhere else in human culture show up in science too.
Sure.
So I'm not painting it as like this Olympian realm, right, where like everyone has these, you know, noble motives and so on and so forth. But people are in the world of ideas and that's what they're fighting about, right? It's not just about like money and, well, some of it is. Anyway, one of the things that impressed me about Elon is, I mean, he's a fairly notable public figure.
Yeah.
But, and maybe this is just because, look, I mean, his profile over the last 4 or 5 years has risen so much that he's almost untouchable right now. Sitting down with the guy, like he was guns blazing, you know. He's a pretty candid dude. Actually, before I went to do that piece, I reached out to Tom Junod at Esquire, who had profiled him before I did, maybe 2 years before.
Oh, I don't think I've ever seen that profile.
It's a good piece for sure. It's not as good as mine, but you know, just kidding. So I reached out to him and just said like, "Hey, what was it like? You know, I'm going in there." Da 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 da. Elon Musk hates Tom Junod, I should say. and he warned me about that. He's like, don't say my name if you're in there. He said, look, Elon like is constantly convinced that he's the smartest guy in the room, which sounds like a mean thing to say about him. But the good side of that is he's pretty intellectually honest. He's like, you could throw the biggest, meatiest fastballs at him and he's like, give me more.
Yeah.
That's what he wants.
Right.
Whereas if you go in kind of light and try to flatter him and whatever, he's going to be pretty soft, you know, and kind of like annoyed by you. Whereas, you know, with Elon, go like do your biggest, best stuff right up front and he'll engage. And that was the experience I had. Like I went in there, tough questions, and he was like, let's do it.
Generally, when you're writing about a person, whether it's in science or art, there's two components. You're writing about the person's work. I'm going to keep drawing the comparison to an artist, where you're saying, okay, this is the person's music or their painting or their movies, and I'm going to take the actual person behind that and trying to draw insights into them, into their real life, to help you understand their work.
Yeah.
And while that I think that that can be reductive, it's certainly like an accepted format and one that's produced great work in art. When you apply the same ideas to a scientist and you say, I'm going to see about this person's life and their childhood, does that work as a way to describe a scientist?
God, that's such a good question.
I mean, I don't know that you consider Elon Musk a scientist per se, but certainly people have tried to map his childhood or various things in his personality to his life rather than, say, his work with launching rockets.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a shorthand for people who aren't necessarily up on the science to understand someone, but science is in some ways more complicated than music. Not really, actually, but it's a different beast, and scientific lives are often more boring than art lives. So how do you fill that void in a science profile?
I always wonder, it's funny, I'll find myself trying to do that like New Yorker thing when I go to write a piece where I'm like, tall with bushy eyebrows and blah, 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 you know, and then like in getting, I mean, one of the things like how I got access to Elon, for instance, is I said, I wasn't being compromised. I told the people, I had a contact at Tesla who hooked me up with this a guy named Hamish McKenzie. Great guy.
Yeah, I love Hamish. Yeah, I know Hamish.
Great guy. Yeah.
Hamish is a journalist turned PR man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shout outs to Hamish McKenzie.
He's a great dude.
Yeah.
So he got me in the room with Elon, which makes him even, you know,
that was funny, legendary. When you were saying that, I was like, well, if I was in the situation, the only contact I would have was Hamish McKenzie.
So, and one of the things in the course of those conversations, I mean, of course, it was emails back and forth with, you know, SpaceX PR and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was able to say to them sincerely and point to my previous work is like, I don't care about Elon Musk's personal life. I don't. He's interesting to me as a figure in the broader history of space exploration, which I regard as an important thing in kind of like the entire human project.
Yes.
Right? And be sincere about that. Like, I'm not trying to sneak inside questions about like his divorce or his second wife or whatever. I really don't care.
Yeah.
I feel like when I read some science features and there's that like shoehorned in kind of personal color about, you know, it reads shoehorned into me.
Right.
For me, it's there if it's like natural to the piece, but if it's a piece about ideas, it's a piece about ideas. And, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm not trying to add reportage, like color, you know, here and there, whether it's setting or whatever. But I don't think that a person's personal life is always the most revealing or interesting aspect of them.
How do you feel that? I mean, when you're trying to do Citizen Kane without Rosebud, like what else goes in that space? Like there's only so much capacity for theories and ideas. Like if you're writing purely with theories and ideas.
Yeah.
That's an academic piece.
Yep.
When you don't have the person's personal life, is there a technique for other distractions in a piece?
Yep. It's the history of whatever endeavor they're in.
Uh-huh.
So like you just read my cosmology piece, which as you noted, like traffics heavily in the history of cosmology all the way back to antiquity.
Yeah.
So I could have spent those words. And I'm not, this is just what I do.
Sure.
This is like, you know, so I'm not, these aren't normative claims.
I think you're one of at least the first three science journalists who've been on the show. So you're not over treading anyone else's technique at this juncture.
Fair enough. I could have spent those words going deep on the biography of like John Kovac, who is the lead researcher on this experiment that was at the center of this piece, or one of the two theorists that were feuding, right, that we talked about.
Yeah.
I could have spent thousands of words. It's a 9,000 word piece. Mm-hmm. You know, 1,000 or 2,000 of those could have been like, you know, where they grew up and blah, blah, blah. But to me, it was more interesting to bring the reader along with like, let me try to give you in that short span of time that you're reading this article, like, let me just take you through the history of cosmology. So you have like a context for like these like very kind of cerebral and abstract discoveries having to do with the cosmic microwave background, which is the afterglow of the Big Bang, right?
Is that a conscious attempt to take the reader on a journey through that person's education, which is to say, if this scientist went to graduate school in the 80s, this is the history that they would have been building upon in their own work?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm trying to place them in the history of ideas, not in like their personal history necessarily. But the caveat I wanted to add to that, though, is that, and this is why I say this is particular to me, sometimes I wonder if that's just a, like, I'm a big believer in playing to your strengths, you know? And
yeah.
I don't know that doing that whole, like, you know, here's this dude's childhood is right. like my game, you know? Like, I think you got to play to, like, what are you kind of, what do people respond to in what you write, you know?
Well, I think most, I mean, I'm interested in talking to you about that because I think that most people's strength is observing small human things, how someone orders a soda or something and trying to do that. And in some ways, tackling the history of cosmology is a higher bar. But I'm interested when you start going back and saying, I'm going to situate this all in the history of cosmology. Mm-hmm. The history of cosmology probably could fill a whole shelf of a bookshelf easily. Mm-hmm. How do you pick the details? Yeah. How do you know what's important to someone in this story?
It's the same journalistic skill set that you do, like, when if you go hang out with the person that you're doing a profile with, right? Yeah. And you're, like, looking for those kind of bright, shiny moments.
Moment. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing, right? Like, I read a couple histories of cosmology for this piece and talked to some researchers and, like, historians of science for it. And I'm just, you know, like, you're just, it's the same kind of thing, right? You're just, like, setting your brain, like, following your nose, you know? Yeah. Like, what's the thing that jumps out to you? Like, oh, how weird and fascinating and, like, I'm fascinated with intellectual discovery, so I'm always trying to sit in that moment with, like, someone in history who, like, had that first thought, like, whoa, those are galaxies. Wow. Like, that's cool, and you can find that on the page. You know, you can surf through a 500-page history of a subject and, like, pick out the six events that were pivotal and, like, drop those into a paragraph and make that really powerful.
Does that knowledge in yourself build upon itself? So when you're doing these pine trees that are in some ways the best gauge of human climate history that we have, and then you're doing cosmology, which is about our history of our relationship with the stars, are you starting to build a knowledge base where you're like, oh, I already did this one. I already know this part.
Without getting too cheesy about it, right? Like, nature is one thing, you know? And so inevitably those connections are kind of suggesting themselves to you as you write about nature more and more.
So when you look at your own work and the stuff you're commissioning, like, are you trying to cover a whole spectrum? I mean, do you think about, like, wow, we've never done a story on X. I need to find a person to do that. Is getting somewhere new important, or is it what's the biggest issues for a average reader?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. I'd say, like, for me personally, in both commissioning and writing, to connect up the sort of degraded caste of science journalists with the larger journalistic community, I don't know about you, but everyone you have in this room, tell me, like, they're easily bored. That's, like, just, like, uniform quality of journalists or writers. So I'm like that too. So yeah, I'm looking around for, like, okay, you know, what's the next thing that's, like, going to get me off, you know, and to think about for some, like, a period of months.
You've been now part of this Aeon experiment for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Where do you go from here? Like, you've got a body of work. I mean, you've done a lot of features over 2 years.
This is an exciting time at Aeon. We're on the cusp. We're sort of relaunching in this summer.
Oh, really?
And we are going to, I mean, Aeon is going to be a transformed thing. We're going to be doing short form stuff.
What?
Yeah. I know. I knew I couldn't come in here and say that, but no. We're going to be doing some short form. We've been experimenting with some new kinds of content, and we're basically, I mean, what we think, we bring, like, a really distinctive approach to ideas. We love doing stuff with a historical or philosophical dimension to it. We're going to continue that and try to expand our project and involve more people. I mean, I think we worry sometimes that we've got this, like, little rarefied slice of the world, and we want to kind of expand our mission, you know, beyond that. And yeah, I mean, keep your eye on us, I think.
Okay, well, so I understand what that means to expand your mission in terms of writers and getting more people involved and more editors and potentially more more different content types or whatever that means. But what does it mean to expand your audience? Like, who are you reaching and how do you reach them?
Paul Haynes, who's our, you know, our founder, just look, I mean, from the beginning, he's been really committed to kind of bringing in a larger audience and not having this kind of really precious, like, look, I love Orion.
Yeah.
You know, I love what they do. But it's for a small amount of people. Like, Paul has been pushing the envelope for us from the beginning that, hey, we want, you know, a bigger audience. We want to push out to more people. And, you know, we want to affect the cultural conversation, not just, like,
within
this very kind of, like,
circles.
London Review of Books kind of, like, ooh, you know, very precious intellectual crowd. you look at the intellectual landscape, and I feel like we're covering it in a really distinctive way.
Yeah.
But we've got like a 2 or 3 month, I mean, our stuff is crafted and honed over a period of 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And so, if not, in my case, longer.
Yeah.
So, like, there's events on the ground. For instance, one small example.
Yeah.
Have you seen, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but Mauna Kea, which is a volcano in Maui, right?
Absolutely not. Even okay. if you had pronounced so that properly, there was no way I would have just sailed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, clearly I'm butchering it anyway. So there's a volcano on Maui,
yeah.
which is like the best place in the Northern Hemisphere to do astronomy. There are like 13 observatories on the top of it, and they're this big consortium of universities is trying to build a new one called the 30-meter telescope, which is would be the biggest land-based telescope in the world and would yep. do all kinds of neat things. But the Hawaiians have objected because the volcano is holy in a Hawaiian sense and for environmental reasons. And so there's been this fight that's broken out among the native Hawaiian population and the scientists that are trying to put this telescope on top of this mountain.
Yeah.
Initially when I saw that, like I'm this like kind of like lamely kind of enlightenment dude where I'm like nothing shall stand in the way of science, you know, right?
Yeah.
But then like you started hearing from historians on the subject and there's actually this really complicated and kind of sordid relationship between imperialism and science and even astronomy specifically
yeah.
for a long time. Like I would have loved to commission a piece that was like really responsive within a week's time
right.
that could give that perspective on the issue,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, shifts my perspective on it, right?
Right. The difference between the operation that you run now
mm-hmm.
and one that can do that is more people, more resources. Like what?
Yeah.
How do you transform that?
More people, more resources, and less rigidity in the kinds of content that we put out. You know,
okay.
so like you know, not everything has to be like a superbly crafted. Well, we think superbly crafted.
Yeah.
Like long form essay. You know, we can come at these issues in a more responsive.
Science
we can have a historian drop a real quick. You know, hey, reality check on the history of something like this, and we're well placed to do it. Right. Right.
And you got no competition.
We got no competition. We like to think.
so that's the project that you see going forward is yeah. getting the million year view and the this week view in sync with each other.
Were you listening to our meetings this week? Or, no. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. Like something like that. And that's one aspect of it. But
yeah
for sure. I mean, I think we're just the last couple of years of just doing the kind of really crafted essays has been wonderful. And it's, you know, it certainly refined a lot of my skills, and it's been awesome, and I'm so proud of what we've done. But we just, you know, we want bigger, we want more of an impact, you know.
Yeah.
We don't want just people who listen to this podcast to know what Aeon is.
I'm not going to be insulted by that statement.
No, you should. You're a member of the elite, right?
I've said this before, but that is as good a place to end as any.
Yeah. Hey.
Thank you very much, Ross Anderson. I will see you in 10,000 years or so to discuss this further. We will be back next week. And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff, our intern, Molly Bain, our sponsors, Alarm Grid and Tiny Letter from MailChimp. Check them both out. Get our app. See you next week.